Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, August 21st. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. Well, first let's have a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa City area, it will be partly cloudy, the wind from the northwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 85 and a low of 55. Tomorrow, Sunday, it'll be partly cloudy, a high of 85 and a low of 67. Then on Monday, isolated storms are possible. We'll have a high of 90 and a low of 69. On Tuesday, again, isolated storms possible, with a high of 90 and a low of 68. The normal high for this day is 83, the normal low, 62. The record high was 99 in 1916. The record low was 45 in 1950. The sun will set tonight at 7:58. It will rise tomorrow at 6:22. We have a little weather story today. This one from meteorologist Kaylee Plichel. Drought conditions continue. Drought conditions continue to expand in this week's drought monitor update. All drought conditions increased slightly, with almost 79% of the state under some sort of drought condition. Severe drought conditions now go from the western portions of Clayton and Delaware counties to Linn County and through the far northern portions of Powashiuk, Iowa, and Johnson counties. Cedar Rapids and Waterloo continue to see rainfall deficits of 12 to 13 inches for the year. The USDA is reporting that 61% of the state's topsoil moisture is short or very short right now, and 52% of agriculture land in the United States is short or very short as well, which is an all-time high for 2021. And now let's turn to the front page of the Gazette for today's first story. Here's one. Iowa City rewards efforts to fight climate change. Solar projects, energy efficiency, and climate education are planned. This story is by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Iowa City. So many worthy causes, not enough money. That's how Brianna Hoffman of West Branch felt when she thought about supporting both local social service agencies and groups that fight climate change. Quote, I've always been passionate about our community, but at the same time I want to help the climate, because I think our planet is in trouble, Hoffman said. I realized you can do both. By helping nonprofits be more energy efficient, you can actually, pardon me, while I find the rest of the story. Let me begin that sentence again. By helping nonprofits be more energy efficient, you can actually help the planet and the nonprofit. The money they don't spend on electricity is going back into their purpose. Hoffman helped Iowa City's Domestic Violence Intervention Program apply for a $10,000 Community Climate Action Grant to go toward a solar installation. The City of Iowa City chose the project as one of seven to share $60,000 in grants for the 2021 cycle. Those funds were distributed in July. With a city grant and two Rotary Club grants totaling $10,000, DVIP has raised $31,000 toward its $80,000 goal for the solar installation. The nonprofit will continue to raise money to buy more panels before the installation next spring. A $36,000 system would prevent the emission of 16.6 metric tons of carbon dioxide, according to the group's fundraising page. Once the system is paid off, savings on electric bills could be funneled back into the group's mission of serving survivors of physical, mental, and financial abuse in 8 southeastern Iowa counties. Quote, The more panels we add, the less time it takes to pay it off, because the cheaper it is per panel, Hoffman said. Shelter House also received a $10,000 city grant to go toward putting solar panels on the roof at its 70-bed emergency shelter. Deerfield Common, a townhouse complex on the east side of Iowa City, had major problems with ice dams last winter, said Kathleen Fitzpatrick, 66, a homeowner and treasurer of the Deerfield Common Homeowners Association. Fitzpatrick said, quote, "Turns out poor insulation in venting and attics is one of the causes of ice damming. We found some places where there was absolutely none. It had just deteriorated." Deerfield Common applied for and received a $10,000 climate change, a $10,000 climate action grant from the city. With the grant and cash reserves, the HOA will pay $17,000 to install insulation in all 24 attics, reducing energy use and electric bills. Fitzpatrick said, quote, "Had we not gotten the grant, we would have had to do a special assessment. We've got some young families, some people on a fixed income, and some single people. The Iowa City Bike Library will use its $10,000 grant to do an energy audit and site analysis with the goal of being carbon-free in 5 years, according to the group's application. The Bike Library, established in 2004, bought its first building earlier this year and plans to use the city grant to update windows and doors to increase natural light and energy efficiency. The South District Neighborhood Association will use its $8,885 city grant for a youth disaster preparedness event. Planners will engage school-aged children who will receive Raspberry Pi computer systems and learn STEM skills through assembling the computers. The application notes, quote, "Students will use these computers to learn about resilience and extreme weather through gaming and participate in interactive discussions." Other grants include $6,175 for a study on establishing resilience hubs to serve vulnerable populations during times of extreme weather or natural disaster, and $5,000 for a group to create 125 energy care packages for lower-income households. Iowa City received 25 applications for the Climate Action Grant Program, funded through a $1 million emergency levy the Iowa City Council approved in the fiscal 2021 budget. Assistant City Manager Rachel Kilberg said, "Nonprofits, businesses, or K-12 students based in Iowa City may apply for grants for projects that can be completed in 12 months. Match the city's climate action goals, are impactful and measurable, and benefit a diversity of Iowa City residents. The next application period is expected to open in March." And now we'll turn to another story from the front page. Medical marijuana manufacturer heads for Iowa City. State will allow Iowa Cannabis Company to transfer license from Cedar Rapids. And this story is by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Soon, the Iowa Cannabis Company will be able to manufacture and sell medical marijuana products in Iowa City. The Iowa Department of Public Health has allowed the company to transfer its license to manufacture medical marijuana products from Cedar Rapids to Iowa City, where the firm also will open a dispensary for consumers this fall. Quote, ICC Manufacturing has asked to relocate its manufacturing facility to Iowa City. Owen Parker, program manager for Iowa's Office of Medical Cannabidiol, said in a meeting Friday of the Iowa Medical Cannabidiol Board. That didn't read very well, but nevertheless. ID, quote, IDPH did grant that approval, and local zoning authority has been provided. They will have operation to begin in 2021. The manufacturing site under consideration is in an industrial zone in the south end of Scott Boulevard on Iowa City's southeast side, officials said. Pardon me. Iowa Cannabis's Iowa City dispensary, one of five in the state, was supposed to open by July 1st, but the state gave the company an extension to start selling products October 1st. The company will open a dispensary in Cedar in Council Bluffs at the same time and has operated a Waterloo dispensary since 2018. The Iowa City dispensary will be in the strip mall by Harbor Freight and La Regia Taqueria, city officials told State Senator Joe Bolcom, a Democrat from Iowa City. More than 6,000 Iowans have qualified to be in the medical marijuana program, which addresses a dozen different conditions, including Parkinson's disease, cancer, and autism. In June 2018, the State Public Health Department announced it would award the second of two state manufacturing licenses to Iowa Relief for a facility in Cedar Rapids. The first Iowa manufacturing site was MedFarm Iowa, which opened in 2018 in Des Moines. Iowa Relief built a 5,000 square foot cannabis cultivation and processing plant at 1420 26th Avenue Court Southwest and started manufacturing a marijuana tincture there in 2019. But then the COVID-19 pandemic hit, and the number of Iowans participating in the medical marijuana program fell off temporarily. Iowa Relief closed its operation and turned in its license in early 2020. In February, the state gave Iowa Cannabis Company a license to manufacture medical marijuana products at 5137 18th Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. But in the months following, the company asked the Public Health Department if it could instead open its manufacturing plant in Iowa City. Iowa Cannabis is connected with Cannabis and Glass, a large recreational marijuana store in Spokane, Washington. Owner Aaron Boschart told the Gazette in December 2019, the profits from the Washington State stores help support its Iowa medical marijuana operations. Boschart did not respond to a message seeking comment on Friday. All right. Now I'll pause for just a second and have a sip of coffee. All right. Turn to the Iowa Today page for this story. University of Iowa, Iowa City schools won't mandate masks. District exploring legal options. And this story is by Grace King and Vanessa Miller of the Gazette. Iowa City. Officials with both Iowa City Schools and the University of Iowa on Friday said they can't require face coverings in their buildings or on their properties despite a new Iowa City mask mandate that specifically identifies public school and University of Iowa academic spaces as being included. The University of Iowa and the Iowa City Community School District, which start their fall semesters Monday, both strongly encourage vaccination and masking, regardless of vaccination status, in accordance with guidance from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But given action taken by the legislature, the governor, and the State Board of Regents in May, officials said they can't enforce Iowa City Mayor Bruce Teague's emergency order issued Thursday evening, requiring masks in all classrooms, stores, restaurants, and churches through September 30th. Quote, "While the university appreciates the sentiments expressed by the mayor, his order does not and cannot apply to the University of Iowa," UI Vice President for External Relations Peter Mathis wrote in a Friday morning message to University of Iowa College Deans. Quote, "As a state agency, the university must comply with our state law and our governing body, the Board of Regents, State of Iowa." In an email to families Friday, Iowa City Schools Superintendent Matt Degner said he applauds Iowa City's efforts to mandate masks. But, he said, the school district is expected to follow state law and guidance from the Iowa Department of Education, which prohibits school districts from requiring the use of face coverings. The Iowa City District is mulling potential legal paths to protect students, staff, and families from COVID-19, seeking guidance from the U.S. Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Office of Civil Rights. Quote, "Student and staff health and safety continue to be our top priority," Degner said in an email. "Wearing a mask is an opportunity for our entire school community to support each other and help slow the spread of COVID-19. The Iowa City emergency order, enacted in light of rising COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations, conflicts with a bill Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law in May, barring school boards from enacting mask mandates in schools. The Board of Regents in May also ordered its three public universities to return to in-person learning this fall and to no longer require masking or social distancing on campus. Governor's office spokesman Pat Garrett, reacting to the Iowa City masking order, said it's, quote, not enforceable. In Mathis' statement to the University of Iowa campus Friday, he referenced messaging done earlier this week about vaccination and masking. Quote, "The University of Iowa strongly encourages face masks in all classroom settings and during in-person office hours, according to a campus message this week, which noted Johnson County has the highest vaccination rate in the state, with 71% of those eligible getting the shot. Quote, "Please do your part to keep our community safe by getting your free vaccination today." And now I will turn to the Insight page of the Gazette and begin with this editorial. It's the Gazette's editorial. Cooperate on rescue funds. The city of Cedar Rapids is receiving $28 million from the federal... The city of Cedar Rapids is receiving $28 million from the Federal American Rescue Plan. Linn County is receiving $44 million through the legislation passed by Congress. During a presentation to the City Council last month, staff discussed the broad outlines of how the city would like to spend those funds. Housing and social services were among the city's top priorities, and city leaders hoped to coordinate those efforts with Linn County. Linn County leaders are holding public hearings this month to get input from residents on how best to spend the county's rescue plan dollars. Housing and social services also appear to be at the top of the list for those attending. The county plans to start accepting applications later this year from organizations to apply for a share of the funds. While the county and city held a joint news conference to discuss relief funding last month, the city has moved forward with funding some of the identified priority areas, while the county continues to gather feedback and has been less detailed on how funds would be spent. At the county's first public forum, there weren't any funding buckets identified, just areas it could spend the funds under federal guidelines. Meanwhile, the city leveraged existing feedback based on post-derecho outreach efforts and ongoing needs from service providers, nonprofits, and other partners. If the city and county go their own way, it's a missed opportunity. Working together, they could seek more ambitious and affordable housing options and more robust services for residents who need help. Those are regional problems that demand regional cooperation. Among Cedar Rapids' other priorities is West Side flood protection in the city's core, which also is home to county facilities. It's another opportunity for cooperation, especially with the influx of federal dollars. It's a subject that's come up many times in recent years. City officials say they'd like the county's help. County leaders say they'll consider it if the city requests help. Then nothing gets done. The lack of cooperation has been a frustration for years. Every election, candidates promise to do better and work together. It's an issue every election because the promises don't become action. Sometimes the differences are substantive, but other times personal conflicts and politics poison the well. Deciding how to spend federal dollars to help city and county residents presents a fresh chance to prove that cooperation on major initiatives is possible. City officials have expressed interest in coordination. The county shouldn't miss this opportunity. And again, that is the Gazette's editorial. And now, I'll turn to community letters. And today there's just one letter, this one from Mary McBee of Tama. History tells the tale in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, located smack dab between the East and West, has been repeatedly attacked throughout history, always without success. The English tried to invade and control this country. The Russians then followed suit, pursuing a long war. Neither succeeded. You'd think history would be telling. After the 9/11 attacks in 2001, Republican President George W. Bush quickly responded by declaring war on Afghanistan. This horrific 20-year war has left numerous civilians killed along with many military personnel. And on the false report that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, none of which were ever found, Bush also sent our troops into Iraq. Eventually, Democratic President Barack Obama was able to locate and kill Osama bin Laden, whom they found living with his family in Pakistan. In 2014, Obama ended our major combat operations in Afghanistan, leaving only support and training personnel. Then Republican President Donald Trump promised to bring all our troops home from Afghanistan. The current president, Democrat Joe Biden set September 11th, the 20-year anniversary of 9/11, as the deadline for removal of all our troops from Afghanistan. Now, criticism of Biden abounds. Yet, he's the only president in the last 20 years who's had the backbone to cease this never-ending war. And again, that letter is from Mary McBee of Tama. Okay. Here is a story from the Iowa Today page. Iowan charged in Capitol riot may be returned to jail. He violated terms of his release, prosecutor says. And this story is by David Pitt of the Associated Press. A prosecutor says a Des Moines man seen in a videotape confrontation with a police officer during the Capitol insurrection should be returned to jail until the trial because he violated terms of his release by watching anti-government internet videos about the January 6th attack. Douglas Jensen, 41, was released in July after spending 6 months in jail. At the time, Jensen told a judge that he had been duped by QAnon conspiracy theories, saying he bought into a pack of lies and had since experienced a wake-up call. 30 days later, on August 13th, a pretrial services officer found Jensen in his garage in Des Moines, listening to the news on a video sharing website similar to YouTube that features anti-vaccine and anti-government content, according to a court filing Thursday. Acting U.S. Attorney Channing Phillips wrote that the swift violation confirms what the government and the judge suspected all along, that Jensen's alleged disavowal of QAnon was just an act. Jensen's defense attorney, Christopher Davis, declined to comment and said he planned to file a reply on Monday. Video of the January 6th insurrection shows Jensen wearing a T-shirt bearing the letter Q, a symbol of the QAnon conspiracy theory, when he joined a mob that approached the Capitol Capitol Police Officer Eugene Goodman inside the building and followed the officer up two flights of stairs. In releasing Jensen, U.S. District Judge Timothy Kelly said he didn't put too much weight on Jensen's claims. He also told Jensen that if he accessed the internet, he would be returned to jail. Court documents say that when the officer found him this month, Jensen was using an iPhone that he said he got from his wife 2 weeks earlier, even though his wife had promised to help him comply with the judge's directions. He admitted to watching additional content promoting conspiracies about the 2020 presidential election. Quote, contrary to what Jensen claimed at his bond hearing, he is still very much bought into QAnon's pack of lies, Phillips wrote. Jensen faces charges including civil disorder and assaulting, resisting, or impeding a law enforcement officer. All right. Now I'll take a sip of coffee. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, August 21st on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now let's turn to today's obituaries. Well, first we have the short notices from Bennett. Ruth Irene Wiley, 82, died Thursday, August 19th. Arrangements are with the Fry Funeral Home of Tipton. From Cedar Rapids, Fern Netol Licky, 91, died Friday, August 20th. The arrangements are with the Pepe Cuba Funeral Service of Cedar Rapids. From Marion, Lyle Dean Roberts, 60, died Wednesday, August 18th. Arrangements are with Iowa Cremation of Cedar Rapids. From Wheatland, Marvel Beneshek, 87, died Thursday, August 19th. Arrangements are with the Chapman Funeral Home of Clarence. Now we'll drop down the page for the longer notices. From Cedar Rapids, Gerald J., also known as Jerry Byrne, 80, of Cedar Rapids, passed to eternal life Wednesday, August 18th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, August 22nd at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, August 23rd at St. Ludmilla's Catholic Church with the Reverend Ken Glazer officiating. Burial will follow at St. John's Seminary. St. John's Cemetery. From Tipton, Ruth Irene Wiley, 82, of Tipton, passed away on Thursday, August 19th, while under the care of Iowa City Hospice and with loving family by her side. A memorial service officiated by Pastor Ron Lashmit and Bob Knight will be held at 2 p.m. Sunday, August 22nd at Fry Funeral Home in Tipton. Just prior to Ruth's service, there will be a time of visitation from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Immediately following services, family and friends are invited to share in a time of memories at the Bennett Community Center, American Legion. From Minnetonka, Minnesota, on August 15th, Garrett, also known as Gary Duggleby, passed away at his home in Minnetonka at the age of 73. A service will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, August 21st, with visitation at 1:30 p.m. at Cremation Society of Minnesota in Edina, Minnesota. From Newhall, Daryl James Kessner, 87, of Vinton, formerly of Newhall, passed away peacefully on August 17th at the Keystone Care Center after battling Parkinson's disease for more than a decade. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. August 22nd at St. John's Lutheran Church in Newhall. His life will be honored at 10:30 a.m. Monday, August 23rd at St. John's Lutheran Church in Newhall, where he was a lifelong member. Christian burial will take place at St. John's Lutheran Church Cemetery. From Iowa City, Raymond J. Pechos, that's spelled P-E-C-H-O-U-S, passed away on August 18th at 76 years of age. A celebration of Ray's life will be held on Monday, August 23rd, with a visitation for family and friends from 3 to 5 p.m., followed by a Mass at 5 p.m. at St. Thomas More Catholic Church in Carlville. A reception will be held directly after in the parish hall. In lieu of flowers or gifts, donations may be made to the Jeff Pechos Family Sclerodoma Fundraiser or St. Thomas More Capital Campaign. For the safety of all, we request that masks be worn. From Cedar Rapids, Owen Mack, 87, of Cedar Rapids, passed peacefully on Tuesday, August 17th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. A private family funeral service will be held on August 29th. And finally, from Olin, Michael Rendon Fall passed away at his home on August 19th. Mike, pardon me, a celebration of Mike's life is planned for 1 p.m. October 23rd at Hammer's Hideaway in Olin. Okay. Now I'll pause for a second, take a sip of coffee. And now we'll turn to the sports page for our story. Well, high school football has started, so we have two stories on the front page of the sports section about high school football. Here is one. More in the tank. Extra conditioning pays off as Lone Tree routes Midland in opener. And this story is by K.J. Pilcher of the Gazette. Lone Tree. Conditioning, depth, and a victory. Lone Tree coach Aaron Bohr added extra conditioning to practice this week to prepare for the season opener. The effort paid dividends as the extra gas in the tank with some strong depth produced a successful start. Bohr said, quote, "It's something we want to take advantage of against a lot of teams because we feel we have a lot of guys that can play. We feel we have a lot of quality depth. We have so many guys who played as sophomores last year, and now they're coming up. It was really satisfying to see basically our conditioning take over. We had a lot of guys step up, but our stars made plays, and that was good to know. And that was good to know we could have them there for all four quarters." Tyler Bell scored two touchdowns. Caden Smith blocked and recovered a touchdown. And Lone Tree's defense stifled Midland for a 22-8 victory in the eight-player prep football opener last night in Lone Tree at Lone Tree High School. The Lions seemed to take over in the second and wear down the Eagles. Bell said, quote, "Coach made us do a lot of conditioning. It made us better." Lone Tree trailed early and even the score late in the second quarter. The Lions pounded the ball effectively, driving 75 yards on 11 plays with four rushes from Bell. He capped the drive with a 6-yard run on fourth down. Case Shields' conversion pass to Case Patterson made it 8-8 with 3:14 before half. Bell said, quote, "My fullback, Joe Boxwell, put the block on the outside guy. I just ran up the middle. We felt unstoppable." Bell added a 3-yard score for a 16-8 lead with 7:52 in the third. The 18-yard drive was set up by the defense's stop on the first possession after the break. Bell had one of at least two sacks and three tackles for loss to force a turnover on downs deep in Eagle territory. He rushed for 72 yards and was all over defensively. Bell said, quote, "I felt amazing. The best thing to do was go out there and wreck." Cade Shield ran for 99 yards for Lone Tree. Both teams managed just one scoring drive in the first half. The Eagles struck quickly on its first possession, actually their first play. Braden Grau took the handoff and rolled around the right end, shaking free of a couple tackles, balancing to stay in bounds and breaking a 54-yard touchdown run. Caden Ballou hit Zane Sauer on a conversion pass for an 8-0 lead with 7:12 left in the first quarter. The Lone Tree defense dominated from that point forward, especially in the second half. The Lions allowed just 22 offensive yards in the second half. They didn't even surrender a first down until after the break. They didn't even surrender a first down after the break until the middle of the fourth. Bohr said he was pleased with how his team responded after the first score. He credited defensive coordinator Chad Shield for the game plan. Quote, "It's a struggle," Bohr said. "It's a challenge in 8-man for sure. But when you've got the athletes, the coaches, and everybody pays attention to the details, yeah, we can absolutely see scores like this from time to time."
Right.
And now we have this story also about high school football. Loaded Lions ecstatic to be back home. Quarterback depth could be a difference maker for Lisbon. The story is by Mike Condon. Don't think for a minute they were not appreciative. The Lisbon football team has spent the past couple of seasons as true road warriors. With Walmer Field undergoing a renovation, the Lions played their home games just down the road in Mount Vernon at Ash Park on the Cornell College campus. Quote, "Cornell has an awesome facility, and it was great playing there for the last few years," said Lisbon coach Phil Whitman. "But there is something special being a Lisbon football player playing at Walmer Field in front of your fans on your own school grounds." Quote, "I just think for us it is going to be awesome to play all of our home games at home this year." When the Lions come charging onto Walmer Field for their opener Friday against West Branch, they will do so with high expectations. Lisbon returns 9 starters from a team that finished 7-3 and qualified for the Class A playoffs in a 2020 season that was a challenge for all teams due to COVID-19. As Whitman begins his 5th season at Lisbon, he is blessed with depth at an unlikely position for a Class A team. Senior Gavin Wollum began the 2020 season as the starter at quarterback. He was sidelined with an injury and was replaced by junior Cohen Camas. Both players put up similar statistical numbers, giving Whitman additional options this fall. Quote, "With Gavin going down with a broken finger, With Gavin going down with a broken finger last season, Cohen stepped in and did a great job," Whitman said. "I see us using both guys this year. Each is totally capable of the starting spot. The best part is that both have gained strength and speed and compete with each other daily in practice. They want each other to do their best and will give everything for the best of the team." Wollum, who threw for 228 yards and 3 touchdowns, also was a standout on defense, getting in on 13 tackles. Camaus threw for 312 yards and 6 scores. Lisbon also has several capable ball carriers returning. Senior Jamian Moore ran for 810 yards on 118 carries, scoring 10 touchdowns. Junior Caden Caspers chipped in with 610 yards and 6 scores. Seniors Max Cole, 296 yards, 3 TDs, and Will Bennett, 217 yards, 2 TDs, are other options returning for Whitman. Quote, "Offensively, we will be looking to get the ball into our playmakers' hands quicker and utilize the width of the field," Whitman said. Along with Jamian and Max, Caden Caspers and Will Bennett will be some of our playmakers on offense. The biggest concern on offense will be replacing 3 starters on the line. Whitman said he is looking at some juniors and sophomores who haven't had much varsity experience to step up. Quote, what you see from us on the field may look different, but for the linemen, not a ton will change from verbiage to assignments. They played in the same system last year at JV level, Whitman said, of his young group of linemen. My concern would be more with the speed at the varsity level. On defense, Cole and Moore will be the anchors from their linebacker positions, along with defensive tackle Tyson Scott. The speed that will be evident on offense also will be key to the defense. Whitman said, quote, defensively, pressure will be key for us, utilizing a multitude of guys to play on the opposition's side of the ball. Whitman is cautiously optimistic about the season. He cites Wapello and Albernette as teams to watch in the District 5 race. Whitman said, quote, as with most Class A schools, an injury here or there will and can be detrimental. I think we have a very solid group of kids that have learned to compete in athletics. We have guys that are key members from a state runner-up wrestling team, a state runner-up track team, and a state tournament baseball team. If we can bring our young guys up to speed, our goal is to be 1-0 each week. And now I will turn to the back page of the Gazette for our Dear Abby column. All right. Former addict needs to reclaim life. Dear Abby, I'm a 39-year-old woman in a toxic relationship with my boyfriend of almost 7 years. We had a child together, but lost custody due to drug use during my pregnancy. Even though we don't have our son, and he treats me badly, I feel I have to stay with him because we have gone through so much together. A couple of years ago, I got dentures because I ruined my teeth when I was using, and now I'm afraid no one will want to be with me because of them. So I'm stuck in a relationship that isn't good for me. It's embarrassing to have dentures at such a young age, and I don't know how I will be able to meet someone who can see past them and my drug history so I can be in a healthy relationship. I feel like my only choices are to stay stuck in this toxic relationship forever or end up alone. How do I move past my insecurities? And this letter is signed, Embarrassed in Arizona. Dear Embarrassed, please do not allow your fear of being alone to prevent you from taking another important step in reclaiming your life. If you rely on your boyfriend for financial support, find a job. Make arrangements with friends or family so you can eventually save enough to live independently. After you have left him, being alone does not necessarily have to be a bad thing. In your case, it could be therapeutic. And once you are financially stable, consult a dentist or a school of dentistry about what options you might have beside dentures. Okay. And that is the Dear Abby column. And now, well, see what else we have here in the paper. Okay. Just pardon me while I sort through it. Here's an article from the living page of today's Gazette. It appears under the title History on a Roll. Mobile Museum comes to Wilton. The State Historical Society of Iowa's Mobile Museum is on a roll and has arrived in Wilton. After 3 years of bringing history to all of Iowa's 99 counties, the custom-built Winnebago is outfitted with a new exhibition, Iowa History 101, Iowa's People and Places. This 300-square-foot museum exhibit on wheels is packed with 56 artifacts and videos exploring 13,000 years of Iowa history, from its earliest residents to those who call it home today. Okay. It will be parked on Cedar Street in Wilton during the Wilton Founders Days and will be open for free. Self-guided tours from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. today and Sunday. Quote, "Our first statewide tour was an enormous success, and Iowans let us know they wanted this traveling museum to keep rolling with another exhibition," Susan Clower, administrator of the State Historical Society of Iowa, said in a news release. "We're eager to share more stories with Iowans across the state." So are the EMC insurance companies. So are the EMC insurance companies, which sponsored the first tour and renewed its support for the second. Quote, "EMC Insurance Companies has deep roots in Iowa," EMC President and CEO Scott Jean said in a prepared statement. "We're proud to be a part of our state's history and excited to help share it with Iowans across the state." The Mobile Museum will visit all 99 Iowa counties through 2023, similar to its first three-year tour. The first Mobile Museum exhibition made 175 stops from 2017 through 2019 and attracted nearly 65,000 visitors, including 11,400 students. The new exhibition unpacks some of the stories of Iowa's past with an eclectic array of artifacts selected from the State Historical Museum of Iowa in Des Moines, and its introduction video is narrated by WOI-TV host Jackie Schmillen. Highlights include a token from the Hudson Bay Company from Dubuque County in 1800, an election ticket from 1860, knitting needles from Iowa First Lady Jane Kirkwood of Iowa City, used to knit clothing for soldiers during the Civil War and World War I, a birch bark lunchbox a Cerro Gordo County boy used in the 1870s, a Meskwaki cradleboard from the late 1800s, a University of Iowa pennant from Edward Carter of Monroe County, who in 1907 became the first African-American to get a medical degree from the University of Iowa. A paper fan promoting women's suffrage from about 1916. A menu from Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev's visit to Des Moines in 1959. An Iowa State University women's track uniform from 1972, the year Title IX passed. One farm family's first radio, showing how electricity changed life for rural Iowans. Boots worn by the Des Moines Water Works director during the flood of 1993. A flight suit worn by native Iowa astronaut Peggy Whitson of Beaconsfield. Okay, Iowans may request a visit from the Mobile Museum for schools, libraries, local museums, community festivals, county fairs, and other places where people gather. Visits to the Mobile Museum are free, and the tours are self-guided. For more information, go to www.iowaculture.gov and follow the Mobile Museum's statewide history at facebook.com/Iowa History. Let's see what else we have here. Well, I'll just give a quick recap of the weather for eastern Iowa. In the Cedar Rapids, Iowa City area today will be partly cloudy, the wind from the northwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 85 and a low of 55. Tomorrow, Sunday, it'll be partly cloudy, with a high of 85 and a low of 67. On Monday, isolated storms are possible. We'll have a high of 90 and a low of 69. And then on Tuesday, again, isolated storms are possible, with a high of 90 and a low of 68. The normal high for this day is 83. The normal low is 62. The record high was 99 in 1916. The record low was 45 in 1950. The sun will set tonight at 7:58. It will rise tomorrow at 6:22. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, August 21st. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. And thank you for listening.